There's a boat in the dock, and early at 5 o'clock is a man with his pipe and plaid beret. He has fish in the sea calling out to him with glee, sailor, won't you come and catch me?
Good morning and welcome to A Fine Kettle of Fish, KMUN's Lower Columbia's seafoods show on 5th Mondays at 9:30 a.m. This is your host, Jennifer Burns Bright, a Northwest food educator and travel writer who specializes in the glorious foods of the sea and the people who bring them to us. We're here today to talk about a significant annual catch for fishermen and women in Oregon and Washington, albacore. Oregon's famous celebrity chef, old school James Beard, said it tasted better canned than fresh, but we love it both ways. Generations of Oregonians and Washingtonians grew up eating it from the tin as chicken of the sea, flaked and mixed with mayonnaise for a school lunch or baked in casseroles. It's still one of the most popular fish sold in the country. It's shaped like a silvery and shimmery bullet, and it's been fished commercially on the West Coast for over a century. And the fine, fresh, young ones are sold here along the coast in its short season from about mid-July through September. My guest today is Krista Svensson. She's the fleet manager at Ilwaco Fish Company / Alber Seafoods and a council member of the Pacific Fishery Management Council. She's also a big fan of this gorgeous fish, and she's here to tell us why. Welcome, Krista.
Well, thank you, Jennifer. I am a super fan of albacore.
Nice.
Partially because I have grown up in Clatsop County and Bumblebee started here in Astoria, which means I feel personally connected. Mm. Partially because it is absolutely delicious.
It is. I love it.
And it just has such an incredible story in connecting people, both here in the community and beyond. You know, this is a highly migratory species, and we now have science that demonstrates where these fish are going.
How far do they go?
Well, they get started over by Japan, and then they swim back and forth across the Pacific, and ultimately end up down kind of in the South Pacific, based upon what our research is showing from both the Southwest Fisheries Science Center and the American Fishermen's Research Foundation.
That's kind of amazing because, I mean, they're they're not a small fish, but they're a live fish. I mean, they're really like the athlete of the sea more than the chicken of the sea. Can you describe what a tuna fish what an albacore looks like and why it might be, you know, a good swimmer like that?
Well, they are definitely torpedo-shaped, and they are a warm-blooded fish, so they have the ability to swim very, very quickly. And then as well as that, they dive from the surface down to, you know, a couple hundred meters below the surface.
Oh, that's far.
Going to capture prey. Mm-hmm. So they have the ability to eat a variety of species, and they migrate based upon what's in season and chase those schools of fish across the Pacific.
So how do the fishermen catch them then? I mean, it sounds like this, it's quite a chase.
It is quite a chase. And for fishermen here off the west coast of the U.S., which is the eastern Pacific, they use typically either pole and line or trolling, which would be putting poles out alongside the boat. So they kind of, you know, balance out a little bit like wings.
So I was going to say, I see you're moving your hands kind of in like a V shape,
yes,
sticking out. And people can see that. They can identify a troll boat if they look out and they see a fishing vessel with kind of like that V-shaped pole on either side, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. And then from that V-shaped pole, they have individual lines that go out into the water. So each fish, regardless of which gear type they're using, those fish are all caught individually, one at a time, and brought in by hand. And from there, they go into the fish hold. Some of them are caught fresh, and they're put on ice, and they're brought in after maybe a day, maybe a couple of days. And then we have other fishermen that go out for sometimes up to a month, where they bleed the fish, and then freeze them. And there are a couple of different methodologies that they can do, but those fish are typically frozen within 20 minutes of capture and are what are typically used in the sushi market. So
okay.
it's that ability to capture that freshness mm-hmm. so quickly within, say, 20 minutes that allows you to have just a quality product every single time when you're eating albacore.
That's amazing. So they, on the boat itself, they do that freezing right away, and everything is done right there, and then it's just stuck in a, I assume these are bigger boats, a much bigger freezer hold to stay out at sea for up to a month, you said?
Yes. So some of them are bigger boats, and some of them are, you know, maybe 40, 50-foot boats.
Oh,
it just
wow.
depends on the size of the vessel and what they're doing. So, you know, the biggest boats, they have the ability to run all the way down to, say, the South Pacific or Hawaii, and they fish there during the winter months, and then they come back and fish off of our coast and come home and see their families, for example.
Nice.
So those fisheries,
it's always good.
It is always great to see your family when you've been out for a while. And most of those fisheries, at least from a U.S. perspective, were started by fishermen here that started fishing their way across and then in the summers hang out here. And I think it is worth mentioning that the majority of the albacore that is caught on the West Coast is actually frozen at sea. So we think about albacore during summer months and August in particular, because that is when the most fresh typically comes in. And it's one of the reasons why the Oregon Albacore Commission worked very hard with state legislators to make August Oregon Albacore Month.
Good to know. I'm going to be celebrating for sure.
I know. It's super exciting. Super exciting. But it is one of those things to think about in terms of frozen product and the ability to have quality all year, not just in summer months.
So basically, it sounds like from what you're saying, if you buy a properly frozen albacore, you can actually do your own sashimi or ceviche or tuna, any kind of fresh tuna or raw tuna preparation, if it's that sushi grade.
Correct.
Nice.
Correct.
Okay. We'll have to talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. But before we do, I wanted to know a little bit about the history of Bumblebee and Clatsop County and how tuna has been an industry here for quite some time. Kind of took over after the salmon fishery cannery kind of tanked, right?
Well, not exactly, because the salmon canneries, that a lot of that has to do with the war effort and putting dams in for hydropower. That's why we have the Mitchell Act, which allows for salmon hatcheries. And the function of those hatcheries was to provide fish for communities along the Columbia and out along the ocean because we were putting those dams in. And we knew that we were taking that habitat out. But the story of albacore actually happens before that.
Oh.
Where we had basically men, mostly men. I'm not going to say there wasn't a woman sneaking out there.
But, there probably was, yeah.
But typically it was gentlemen going out there, fishermen going out there. And they were looking for what other fish can we catch, because fishermen love to catch fish.
They
and
sure
if it's
do.
Out there, let's go find it and see if we can get a market for it. And what they found was, wow, we have this delicious fish off the West Coast, albacore. And so they started canning it. And then we get to the 40s where we're starting to see a tremendous volume of albacore. We saw landings of albacore in the 40s that are larger than the landings that we see today.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. And part of that was effort. And part of that in terms of commercial is that we were not seeing a lot of recreational. And so we're probably catching the same amount of fish. Mm-hmm. It's just how does that allocation get broken up? And I think that that's really important when you start looking at numbers is, hey, things aren't necessarily crashing. Fish go different places. You know, we may not be seeing something in Oregon, for example. It may be in Washington, or maybe they went to California this year. And so it's just important to be kind of mindful on that point. And then the other component of that is the number of vessels. So we had thousands of trawlers not trawlers, but trollers.
Right.
The guys with the careful, V, kind of the V-shaped poles on their boats.
Instead of trawlers being the nets. So we're talking about trollers. Okay.
Correct. So we had thousands of fishermen that were out there trolling, and that was for salmon and for albacore, because you can use, you know, it's the same configuration for your vessel. It's a little different in terms of the hooks, what you're doing. But when you drop the number of fishermen that are out on the water, you're in general not going to catch quite as many. We do have advances in gear, you know, and the ability to find fish, but still, there are just fewer people doing it commercially today than there were, say, in the 70s.
In the 70s. So Bumblebee, of course, is a famous Clatsop County cannery, Astoria cannery, and they were bringing in lots of the albacore, right? Is that probably the biggest tuna cannery that was around here, or were there a whole bunch of others?
So there were quite a few canneries in the area. Bumblebee definitely was the largest. However, again, numbers, it's a little bit challenging because you can have 30 canneries, but some of them will be the equivalent of working out of somebody's garage, for example.
Sure.
And there's nothing...
Anybody with a canning machine.
Exactly. And there's nothing wrong with that. I myself have a very small business that has nothing to do with seafood.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to have that type of business and that opportunity because we see a lot of innovation coming from multiple businesses doing things all a little differently. That being said, Bumblebee was the largest. And I think it's important to recognize today that while Bumblebee may not be here, Bumblebee is still in existence, but their departure has allowed other companies in the area to develop other products for albacore. So for example, I worked over at Bornstein Seafoods for quite a few years, and we were the largest domestic supplier of albacore loins. So this wasn't going into a can, but it was taking the same fish that we find here and developing it into a new product that the public has grown to love, use, and enjoy.
Yeah, so those already cut frozen albacore loins, right? The beautiful pink color that's about the size of the palm of your hand. Am I getting this right?
Yes. So those would be more of like a medallion or portion.
I see.
This would be a quarter of a fish.
Oh,
but
okay.
It still gives you that ability to barbecue or...
The whole loin.
Mm-hmm. Make sushi. Yes, the whole loin.
All right. So I have to ask you, so if we're going to the market, what are we going to look for while these fish are in season here in Oregon and Washington? What makes for a good loin that you see in the market?
Well, you definitely want a firm fish, you know, so something that is not, I mean, soft is the only word I can come up with.
It can be kind of mealy sometimes, so we're wanting to avoid that.
Correct.
Okay.
You know, I always look at the eyes if it's a whole fish. I want to make sure that they're glossy. If you're looking at gills, I want my fish bled. So I want to make sure that the throat latch has been cut so that they are a bled fish. And then
does that improve the flavor?
I think that it does. I mean, different people have different flavor profiles.
Mm-hmm.
So that will give you a little bit more of a meaty profile, I guess I would say. But it will also give you kind of, you know, you're going to see that red spotting or flecking throughout the meat as well.
So that might be undesirable just given, you know, we're used to seeing a completely, same color fish and...
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
Correct. So typically what you see in the market today is bled. That would be a product that has been bled for you.
So gotcha.
That is, again, something I'm looking at in terms of if I were buying at my dock, I buy both.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a different price point for both of those products.
Okay, we'll talk about that in just a sec. But first, I just want to check in and let you know that you are listening to A Fine Kettle of Fish on Coast Community Radio, and we're talking about albacore with Krista Svensson. So let's go back to that that idea of fish coming across your desk, your dock. You're a fleet manager, and what do you do over there at Awaka Seafood Company?
Well... You know, it differs every day, and I have days where I am working on getting new boats that are interested in delivering to us. I have days where I am organizing what boat is going to deliver first, because we do albacore and we are a major lander of albacore, but we also handle cold water shrimp, we do whiting, we have salmon. For the halibut openers, occasionally we get a halibut, although that is not one of our major categories. Historically, we've done quite a few sardines. So if I have three boats or five boats that all want to come in on Monday morning, then part of that is figuring out what's the priority of getting the fish into our plant so that we can process it the most efficiently, but also communicating with the fishermen where they are in that queue and making sure that they are getting what they need.
So I kind of see you as kind of like an airport controller and I see like a person standing out on the docks, kind of waving in the boats and part Neptune. And I mean, it seems like a really fascinating position and really complicated and always busy. And I understand you've been working really hard right now, especially because the albacore season is just going crazy. And has it been a good season so far?
This season has not been the most robust ever for albacore.
Okay. Very politically correct way to say it.
Yes. Yeah. We still have the opportunity for a comeback. We have had a number of seasons where it started late, and I will say that this season has definitely started late compared to years in the past. I think there is a fair amount of concern just based upon we've come off of two historically low years in terms of landings. So, we want this season to go well. We've got a lot of fishermen out there along the entire West Coast, whether they choose to deliver to our company or not, who are working hard to make a living. And part of that is that the fish have just been really far offshore.
I was going to ask you about that. I know they do need to go further than, say, fishing for salmon, the fishermen, but how far do they need to go usually for albacore, and how far has it been in the past couple of seasons?
So recently, meaning, say, in the last 5 to 10 years,
okay,
we've been in probably anywhere from 80, I mean, there's some fish that come in closer and there's some fish that come in further, but say 80 to maybe 300 miles offshore.
It's a pretty long distance just to go, just to start fishing, yeah.
Correct. However, this year, the fish have been much further than that.
Oh, I see.
So they've been maybe 500 or 800 miles. I mean, they're quite a ways out there. And that just means fewer boats are going out to look, because the fuel is a lot more if they don't find anything.
Yeah, I bet.
It also means fewer boats may go, because now you're looking at needing an international high seas permit. And a lot of our boats have the permitting to do in our EEZ, but they may not have, after that 200-mile mark, the permitting to go even further.
So just to clarify that, we have different kinds of zones for different kinds of permitting when you go out into the ocean. So over 200, right, is international. So it's a different kind of permitting. That's a lot. Yeah, that's significant. That would be a significant cost, and then a totally different game, I'd think, for them.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
So. Well, okay. So how can we, if it's a lean year and we really want to, of course, purchase as much albacore as we can and show that we value our fishermen, what are some of your favorite ways to actually cook these little guys? And I know you love canned tuna, but what about the fresh stuff? Do you grill it?
I do. And I'm going to make one shout out just for a moment, which is to the Oregon Albacore Commission.
Oh, yeah.
Because they do a website where they provide a list of contacts for boats that are actively fishing for fresh. And because this is a year where I think folks may be concerned about, hey, where am I going to get my albacore for canning or for grilling? Because August is coming in September and we've got all sorts of barbecues and fun events coming along. That is an opportunity to at least have some phone numbers if your normal supplier is not available.
And I'll post that link on my my Facebook page for A Fine Kettle of Fish, and it'll link up to the Facebook page for KMUN. So we'll definitely have that for folks. All right, so marinades. We got to talk recipes here.
Yes.
What do you do?
I will admit that I am not that exciting of a person when it comes to marinades.
Maybe that.
Okay. So I'm a member of an olive oil club.
Okay.
And they provide usually a bottle of olive oil and a bottle of vinegar. Maybe it's two bottles. It's three bottles in the pack, and it's two of one and one of the other. So typically, whatever it is that they send me, I try, and it might be a basil olive oil with...
Oh, they're flavored nice, yeah.
Yes, with a, I don't know, Syrah vinaigrette. And I will use that as a marinade, probably put some ginger and garlic in there because I adore both of those.
That doesn't sound boring at all. That sounds awesome. That sounds really good. And I do one with ginger and garlic too, but this is, I've been cooking it for years, even before I moved to Oregon. It was probably one of my first recipes from the New York Times cookbook, like with Craig Claiborne way back. And it is, I mean, this almost sounds gross, but it's half red wine vinegar and half, they use a fruity red, but I've started using rosé because the fruity red kind of makes the albacore loin really that weird like grayish purple color. So half and half vinegar and red wine, and then a ton of ginger and garlic and some olive oil. And then I think the special part that you can't really identify unless you're right there in the kitchen with me is you take scallions and you blacken them on your stovetop, you know, either with an electric stove, you put them right on the grill real briefly, or, you know, you kind of like flame them a little bit and stick that in the marinade bags and put that in the fridge for, I don't know, 12 hours. And it's so good. And I keep cooking it like that. And I want to try other recipes because I've been doing that for like 20 years. So I might be coming to your house to borrow some of your olive oil or something.
Not a problem. I have plenty.
Good. Okay. How do you eat your canned tuna? Are you a tuna fish sandwich fan, or do you do casseroles? What do you do?
I do a little bit of both. And I will admit, when I'm grilling or if I'm baking in the oven, the weather's terrible, I actually make extra so that I can save it, which is very similar to a canned product, meaning with canned fish, it's cooked in the can. So whether it's leftovers from a meal before or it's canned, mentally to me, it is very, very similar. The difference being with canned, particularly with the canning that goes on here on the West Coast. So this is small scale canned goods. Again, you go to any retail market that's a fish market in the area, they'll have their version.
And sometimes with flavors too, like jalapeno and garlic and things like that. Yeah, that's really
correct.
Yummy.
Correct, yes. So the thing about those cans is that that traps the omega-3s and all the natural flavor and juices from those tuna in that can.
Nice.
And so personally, I'm not adding mayonnaise. I'm just mixing up with the juice and the oils from that can. And then maybe I'll add a little bit of celery or some onion or some scallion. And I will use that for a tuna sandwich. Sometimes I do make tuna casserole. That is definitely a favorite. But my all-time go-to is fish hash, where I just cook hash browns until they're brown. And then because the tuna fish is already cooked, the last minute I throw that on the top just to kind of heat it and keep it in big chunks, because otherwise if you put it in too early, it starts breaking up because you mess with it too much. And
right.
It's little tiny flakes, which still is tasty, but it's not the same visual. And then add a little bit of salt. Sometimes it's truffle salt if I'm being extravagant.
Ooh. Oh, yes. Fancy. And I love it.
I know. And otherwise, it's just regular salt and pepper.
That sounds great. That's a very hearty breakfast or brunch or whatever. I don't know if I told you this before, but I was thinking about the whole issue of when you bake or you grill tuna and it gets a little bit tough, like if you overdo it and you cook it through, but then there's always people who are kind of squeamish, and so they don't want it to have, you know, kind of like just the seared with the rare in the middle. So I wanted to tell you about a dish that I discovered using chard as like a wrap around them. So I do little fingers of the filet, and then I wrap them up kind of like dolmas, if you know what that is, like stuffed grape leaves,
Yeah. Except
it's tuna. And I marinate the tuna in olive oil and lemon juice, and I think garlic. I do garlic too, and some oregano. Then I wrap it up in the chard leaves, and I either grill them or I bake them. And that way, they stay kind of tender. So it could be another way to, I don't know, take your tuna to as a lunch to.
Yeah.
Lunch bag.
And I will try it for sure.
You should.
My mom is definitely more on that. I want it cooked super well done. Versus,
she might really like it then.
Versus me, who is more on the, hey, if it's raw in the center, I'm thrilled.
Yeah.
And this, I think, could be a happy medium for both of us.
Well, and that's what I was thinking. And what it does is you can cook it all the way through, but it's still juicy. And so it kind of is the best of both worlds, I think, for folks. And it's based on an old Greek recipe, like an ancient Greek recipe where they would use fig leaves to roll it. And so I tried it with fig leaves, and that was actually really cool because the fig leaves actually imparted a really a very aromatic flavor that Swiss chard doesn't do. So anyway, I just had to throw that in there because this is like, I'd never have an innovative recipe, and this is probably like one of my only innovative recipes. So one more question. I mean, I wanted to know too, so when we talk about traditionally canned albacore, it just seems such a far cry from what we have here. What's the difference?
So the primary difference between traditional canning versus micro canning, which is the term we use in the industry.
Micro canning, okay.
Yes, meaning smaller canners. Generally, it's that single cook packed in its own juice. When you're looking at the traditional canning method, they cook the fish on racks before it ever gets put into the can.
Oh.
And what that allows is it provides better recovery. You can get every pound of meat off of that fish, whereas the methodology that the micro canners are using, they're filleting the fish and putting that in the can, but they're not getting all the little tiny pieces necessarily off of those bones, which that goes into other items. So, for example, we have companies that are making dog treats.
Oh, that makes sense.
So it isn't necessarily healthy. That it's becoming discarded.
Mm-hmm.
It's going into other products. But the main product is single cooked for micro can versus for traditional, where it's cooked before it's ever put into that can and you lose a lot of the flavor.
Okay, so some people I've heard say that traditionally canned albacore kind of tastes a little bit like pet food. I'm not saying that, but it's much, much better to get some of our freshly done, wonderful, high-quality, premium albacore in the cans that we've got around here that you can buy it at fish markets and such around here. So I wanted to say thank you so much for coming and sharing all this information with us. I think it's really important to talk about how these fish are being caught, and so we can really appreciate a little bit more about the fishermen and everyone who's out there doing some pretty significant labor. I mean, to go out 200, 300, 400, 500 miles just to catch albacore tuna, I mean, that's incredible. So I'm hoping that everyone will, if they see a fisherman or they're buying some albacore for their canning project, they'll say thank you. And I wanted to say thank you to you too, Krista, for everything that you do. So thanks for coming on A Fine Kettle of Fish today.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to A Fine Kettle of Fish on the stations of Coast Community Radio, KMUN Astoria, 91.9 FM, KTCB Tillamook 89.5 FM, streaming at coastradio.org, and on your mobile using the TuneIn app. Jennifer Burns Bright, when are we back again with A Fine Kettle of Fish?
So this is going to be the next fifth Monday, which happens in September. Okay. I don't remember the date quite offhand, but just look for that fifth Monday in September.
And we'll have little recorded promo reminders as we get closer to the date.
Yes, we will.
Thank you.
Thank you.